You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Today on The Grave Talks, famous haunts. Warner grew up wanting to be a Ghostbuster, living on a steady viewing diet of unsolved mysteries, sightings, and other paranormal shows. Matt knew he wanted to learn more about the spirit realm and experience it for himself. Eventually, this would lead Matt on a journey of paranormal investigations, including The Conjuring House, Waverly Hills, and many others. Today, we discuss his adventures investigating the dead all over the country.
Well, I mean, my interest in the paranormal goes back probably, I mean, I'm not going to give my age. I'm not that young anymore, but it goes back at least 30 years. As a child, I had a couple of experiences that I didn't put much stock into it. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand what they were. But as a child, I was a huge fan of horror movies, and I still am. They're everything to me. So I remember being little and seeing the movie Ghostbusters, mm-hmm. and it's still one of my all-time favorites. And that sparked a big interest for me. And everybody wanted to be a Ghostbuster when they were a kid.
Yep.
And then, as I got a little bit older and the show Unsolved Mysteries came about.
Yep.
Which was one of my favorite shows, and he would, every year in October, they would do like a mm-hmm. creepy paranormal themed episode. And I'd see more things. It's like, oh, wow, the ghost stuff is a lot more prevalent than I thought it was. It doesn't get as much, hype as everything else. But I said, all right, it's not just me that has these, experiences, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, you got Unsolved Mysteries, and then you have the show Sightings. Mm-hmm. Learn some more stuff. I remember learning about the Sally House in Kansas mm-hmm. on Sightings and just being blown away that things like this were happening to people. And I remember watching the Amityville horror movie and buying the book and being like, there's no way this really happened. This is insane to me. So then, fast forward a few more years and the paranormal programming starts coming out. Ghost Hunters comes out. And it's like, whoa, you can actually do this. This is something you can explore further besides just having an experience and calling it a day. So that made me realize there was a lot more weirdos out there like me, and I didn't feel so strange about it. My friends were never into it, but I had enough of my own experiences where I said, all right, I'm gonna look into this a little further. So no life-changing experiences as a child, just unexplained things. But the true experience that really said to me, like, this is a reason you need to explore this, happened to me when I was about 19, so roughly 20 odd years ago. In my local area, I live in Massachusetts, actually right in the middle of the Bridgewater Triangle. And what I had happened was I was in one of the books. I don't know if it was a Weird Massachusetts, one of those books. I used to buy all the ghost books, all the haunted stuff, so I could know exactly what's going on. There was a road. It's still there. It's still a road. It cuts through a pretty affluent neighborhood, and the road itself is, we'll say, 2 miles long. The first half, you drive through the road, it's all nice houses, it's densely wooded. And then the second half of this road is like a little cut through to get to another major road. And this little part of the cut through goes through reservation land, which at one point was all Native American owned land, like the whole country, basically.
Sure.
And this is part of like state park, state forest now. And the myths and legends and rumors about this property is that, you'd have all these experiences. You'd have people seeing UFOs. They would see giant thunderbirds. You name it, people had seen it out there. So I'm going to say at least a year, my friends and I would go out to this road all the time. We, you know, teenagers, we had nothing better to do, drive around all night. So what we would do is we would drive down the road, come through the fancy neighborhood, drive through the road, turn around at the end and come back again, you know, do a twofer. So one night, my friend and I, it was January. It was a warm January. We decided, yeah, let's go down the road. We got nothing going on. So my buddy that I was with that night, he was kind of a chicken, and you know, he's not listening, so it doesn't matter. He ain't going to hear this. But he used to get scared pretty easily, and I used to thrive off that. I used to love scaring my buddy. So we went driving down this road one night, and on the way down, I was messing with him. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I think I'm going to stop in the middle of the road tonight. I'll turn the lights off. Maybe we'll get out. And he's like, no, just don't do that. Don't do that. No, I don't want you doing that. And I was like, all right, I won't do that to you. So we're cruising through the road on the way through it, and got the windows down because it's a warm night for January. And you feel the air like different. It just felt different. So we get through to the end of the road. We turn around. We're coming back. And I could see he's not too thrilled with what we're doing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the night for him.
Yeah.
So being the good friend that I am, as we get about halfway through this road, I start putting my foot on the brake. And he looks over at me. He's like, dude, what are you doing? I said, don't worry about it. I put my foot on the brake. No sooner do I have my foot on the brake, I turn the lights off. Those lights go off. Right in front of my truck, there's a woman in a white gown with her hands on the hood of my truck. And I only saw her hands, her arms, and then up to basically the neckline of her dress before the lights went on. I freaked out. He's screaming. I'm bugging out. I press the accelerator. The truck won't go anywhere. The tires are just spinning. It won't move. And we can't go anywhere. We're bugging out. Like, why isn't this moving? All of a sudden, the truck moves, but it doesn't go forward. It feels like it was pushed. It went 45-degree angle to the left. And I'm trying to steer the wheel. The steering is not working. My buddy is screaming at me, don't do this. This isn't funny. And I'm looking at him. I said, I can't control this. I'm not doing this. And at the very last second, I was able to jerk the wheel to the right and get us back onto the main road before we hit a giant tree. And we took off out of that neighborhood at about 60 miles an hour. And we pulled over when we got out of there. And we're both like beyond terrified at this point. And
yeah.
I was like, what did you see? And he's like, I saw a woman in a gown with her hands on your truck. I didn't say a thing to him because I had seen the same exact thing. I wanted to corroborate between the two of us before. I was like, I saw this. He explained everything that I had just seen myself. And he never went back down that road again. And I didn't go down there for probably 5 years. I was too scared to go back down that road. And I've only been back down it a few times. I've been meaning to go back out there and really try and see if I can have that happen again. But I believe that's that once in a lifetime experience that was meant to happen. It propelled me to further my research and look for these things more. And I don't regret having it whatsoever.
When you look back on that experience and obviously having a lot of time now between when that initially happened and today, did you ever do any research on the general area to try and see if there was any other individuals who've had a similar experience or try to identify who, why, any of that with that story?
So the research on the road itself is very scant, to say the least. There's like nothing about it. It was, and even in the book that I have it in, it was like a paragraph sized sentence. Like, oh, and you know, it's, this is what the stories are, but there was no evidence. There was no, you know, cliff notes on where they got the evidence from.
Yeah.
It's very hard to find evidence on it. That's why I want to go down and properly document the area, see if I can't do any more research and figure it all out. But I wasn't able to find out much. There wasn't any talks of exactly what I experienced. The primary experiences were Native American in origin, like the Thunderbirds. You know, Bigfoot popped up apparently too, but I think everybody sees Bigfoot nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's an interesting area.
When right after you had that experience, and you were, you know, that face to face with something, I mean, that's a, like you said, it's a once in a lifetime thing. It's a clear as day. It's not a, I heard a voice in a distance, or I just kind of felt off. You saw this woman holding on to your truck and you were not able to physically move. It was altering reality. It was altering your physical, what was going on around you, what you were able to do. How did you process that immediately after? Did you tell your friends about it? Did you tell family about it? What was the immediate aftermath of this for you personally?
the first person I actually called when we got off that road was my mother. And reason being is my mother has always been fascinated by the ghost stuff too. So we always used to watch all these shows together. And prior to this happening, as I had mentioned, we used to go up and down this road all the time trying to find these things. One time I knew that my mother, her boyfriend, my cousin, and my brother were going to be driving up and down the road. So a couple of friends of mine went down the road knowing they were going to be there, and we hid in the woods. Mm-hmm. And we jumped out at them and scared the absolute hell out of them.
Sure.
And so, you know, knowing I did that to her, and then I had this experience, I called her first because I knew she would be floored to hear that this happened down there. My friends that I did tell, I think that they definitely believed me, but they're so skeptical that it didn't really register with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have paranormal friends back then. I just had the normal friends.
Sure.
You know, it took me a long time to find find the rest of the weirdos. So
yeah,
now I'm in good company. But back then I was definitely the outcast. So my friend and I were the only ones that kind of carried that. And then the few of us that used to go out to that road together would talk about the experience. But that was, it was hard to process because it's like, did that really happen? You know, like, you know, we weren't doing drugs or anything like that, drinking, nothing. So that was the whole thing. It's like, oh, I can understand if we were under the influence of something, but there wasn't anything. So it's for us to both have the same exact experience,
yeah,
without even talking about it. That's what sold me that it really did happen. And thinking about it now.
What's the closest you've ever came to having a non-paranormal explanation for it? Because I know when things like this happen, we do, you know, it's, I don't say it's like the grieving process, but there's a process that we go through of trying to make sense of it. And you go to areas of like, well, maybe that's it. And you kind of get stuck on that for a little bit, but then when it's something that real, eventually you end up just kind of accepting of what it was and being something paranormal. But I'm always curious as to the possible explanations that people end up or go through and come to at a certain point as they're going through that process.
Well, I can tell you for that circumstance, I was never able to come up with a logical answer.
No, nothing.
There was nothing. I've played that over in my head for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I've never been able to, well, maybe it was light refraction. There's nothing because of all the things that happened between the truck, the way it was controlled, the mm-hmm. way it was held, the way it moved. It wasn't normal for it to do that. And
sure.
Like I said, the night was dry and there would be no reason for it to act that way. If the roads were wet or snowy, I could have. Because I'm a skeptic. I'm a skeptical believer. I believe what happens to me, but you're going to have to really prove yourself for me to believe it. And
yeah.
I absolutely love debunking stuff. I know it pisses people off, but that's like my thing.
Sure. Well,
I like to be able to put a reason behind it, you know, because I feel like too many people nowadays want their house to be haunted and want to just say, oh, it's haunted.
Sure.
But it propels us to do the right thing and actually find out why it may or may not be.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it should be gone about. And if there is a logical explanation, which there are in many cases, we should be able to accept that. Unfortunately, obviously, you're probably aware where when you do have the logical explanation, most people already have the mindset of my house is haunted or it is not. You telling them either way isn't going to make a damn bit of difference. They're still going to stick it with what their belief is, it seems, in most cases. Obviously, you were brought up around the same time I was. I think we're probably about the same age from everything you've said. And I totally get your childhood. I totally get your interest because it's exactly what I did. There's nothing spookier than Halloween and Robert Stack walking around the Queen Mary with a trench coat on. That's just, you know, that's Halloween at its best. But tell me, having, you know, learned about these things in childhood and having seen some of these cases, some things, you know, documented on Unsolved Mysteries, some things documented on sightings. And then, of course, there's just the books and there's just local lore and local legend and things of that nature. Has there been anything, any cases that have stuck with you since childhood? I mean, for me, Amityville has been one of them. And I've always been trying to dig deeper into that on the air. Obviously, I'm not going into the house. It's a private residence. But over the years, I've been able to talk with many people that were super close to the investigation and really kind of hear some interesting sides that I don't think have been publicly presented before. For you, I know Amityville was one of them, but was there any cases, whether it be locally or whether it be someplace that you ended up having to take a drive to, that you'd always been fascinated with, that when you got more into investigating, you finally got there and you really kind of have the focus on, and you got there to take some time to research and look into yourself at a deeper level?
Well, as you mentioned, Amityville's definitely been you know, the top of my list for a long time. I've gone to the house a few times, taken photos outside, dreamt about getting inside like everybody. And mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to meet with Lorraine Warren a few times while she was still alive, long mm-hmm. before the movies were coming out. People sure. knew who she was, so prominent.
Yeah.
And I asked her, I said, you know, what was your most terrifying case? And she told me Amityville, and that was all I needed to hear.
Yeah.
You know, and knowing all the other stuff that she went through, to say that Amityville was the most terrifying sells it for me. I've always wondered, was it a hoax? Was mm-hmm. it a little blown out of proportion? We'll never really know.
Sure.
But in terms of the place that I was dying to go to, that I was finally able to go to, that's Waverly Hills in Louisville, Kentucky.
Sure.
That was, I remember seeing it on all the shows. I remember seeing a documentary about it and all these rumors about all these potential deaths and, you know, up to 64,000. It's probably closer to 8,000 or 9,000. Still a ton of, you know, mm-hmm. bad history that went down there. And getting to investigate that place was huge, huge thing. It was my bucket list at the time.
Yeah.
And to be able to do it was an incredible experience. I had some amazing experiences there. And that's definitely it for me right now. I've got a lot of places on my list that I'm trying to chalk off.
You know, let's talk about Waverly Hills for a bit, because, you know, that's obviously, it's one that it's on, and I'm not discounting the place whatsoever, but it's almost become like the McDonald's of paranormal investigating. It's like the most common one you hear about, you know, because it is so well known. So many people go there and almost make a pilgrimage to it. And it's become something where it's like everybody knows about it. They know it's haunted. But, you know, a lot of people don't know necessarily the deeper story. And if this is a place that has drawn you in for years, well before it was even a place of, you know, public investigation, you know, where the way it sits today, what was the history for you? What elements of the history? Educate our audience a little bit on what were some of the pieces of the Waverly Hills story that drew you into it, for those who know nothing more about Waverly Hills other than being a very well-known haunted location.
So I remember seeing it on a multitude of programs over the years when I was growing up, and knowing that it was built as a tuberculosis during the tuberculosis outbreak, it was inundated with people, and there's rumors between 8,000 and 64,000 people perished there during this hit. And mm-hmm. they have, it's five stories. It's shaped like a bat wing, which I'll tell you right now, when you're walking in the dark and you think you come to the end of a hall and you look and then there's another hall and then there's another hall, it seems like it goes on forever. But all the different reports of shadow people walking on the ceiling, all the phantom voices. One thing that happened at this hospital was a nurse took her own life by hanging herself up on the fifth floor. And there's some speculation, because obviously we don't know, that she may have not hung herself, but actually been hanged. They believe that she was pregnant due to the fact that they found a fetus in the sewer systems there. Mm-hmm. And she either had an abortion or a miscarriage. And it's thought that she could have been impregnated by one of the doctors. So during this time, if you were a doctor at the TB ward, you lived on campus with your family. They had cottages on the property that everybody stayed there. You never went home. So it's very possible that this could have happened, but no one really knows the, you know, 100% truth, because nobody was there at the time. Mm-hmm. But all this negative energy that could be held there, I'm always drawn to that. And like asylums and hospitals, I think, because in prisons, I feel like energy leaves an imprint on absolutely everything it touches. So to go to a place where there was so much going on, I just feel like this, you're going to get responses. So what also wound up happening here is their morgue is very small. It wasn't made to have such a massive turnaround with people. And next to the morgue, I forget what the room is actually used for regularly, but at one point in time, this room, it's a massive room. It was filled floor to ceiling, wall to wall with bodies that needed to be taken out of the hospital. And back in the day, to get supplies to the hospital, because it was up on a hill, they had a long tunnel that went down to out back behind the hospital. There was a train rail there that the supplies would come in, and there was a little trolley car inside this tunnel that would take supplies up. Due to the influx of deaths, they wound up using that tunnel to take the bodies out so that the patients wouldn't have to see all the people that passed away being brought in and out all day long.
Sure.
So that's now referred to as the body chute. So just that alone right there is a reason to go there. But, you know, all the, I guess you'd call it like urban legends.
Mm-hmm.
When I went there, the place did not disappoint. And I was very happy that that was the case because, you know, it's like meeting your childhood idol and you find out he sucks. You don't want that. And Waverly Hills lived up to everything I had hoped it would.
Sure. What does the future hold for a place like Waverly Hills? Obviously, now I know it's very, you know, highly hunted as a, from ghost hunters. Is that going to be enough to keep it and that structure sound enough to keep going on with it? Or where is it today? What is it like today?
So what they do, I was actually just there a little over a year ago, I would say. And what they do in the fall season, like most of these locations, is they do a big haunted house attraction, which pumps in a ton of money as well. So you can't private ghost hunt it during that season.
Sure.
But they're making a killing off of that. And they're constantly reinvesting the money in this location. I think the first two floors now have all new windows in them. And they're just preserving it for a piece of one history and also paranormal history so they can further paranormal research.
Yeah.
And that's what I love seeing when people get these old places and they preserve them for that purpose. It's incredible.
When you first got to walk into Waverly Hills, and this being a place that you had done research on, were fascinated with for many, many years, and then you're actually walking through its doors, what's going through your mind?
I was in awe. It was like the first time I went to Disney World as a child, and to know that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we walked in and we went into the staging area where you were able to set up your gear and the little gift shops there. And just sitting there, I'm like, I can't believe I'm in Waverly Hills. I've been watching this thing on TV for 10 or 15 years and now I'm finally here. And then you walk out the tunnel and you're brought into the building. It's just this overwhelming sense of, wow, that's the only way I could put it.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible though.
It I'm sure it would be. Let's talk a little bit about Amityville. I know because you said that's an interest of yours, and you've done your fair share of research into it. And I mean, obviously, those of us who have an interest in it, you know, it's one of those where it feels like you dig and you dig, and there's only so much information out there. You know, but there's still individuals who are alive that I think have more story to tell. Christopher Quarantino, you know, I think has more to say on this. At some point, we will see. But it's always been something that has drawn me in. As a child, it was a summer. You know, I was just reading the book and it drew me in, and then watching the movie, and I was always interested in ghosts and the paranormal. In that case, just I don't know what it was about it, but it spoke to me probably because it was one of the most extreme at the time that was documented as a real story. But I've always been interested in what exactly happened there. I came very close to being able to interview George right before he died. Then he died. We had it scheduled and everything. And it was like, oh, are you serious? But over the years, in time, I've never got a chance to talk to Lorraine before she died, but I am friends with her grandson, Chris McKinnell. And he's provided some insight. I mean, he was a child. So, but he obviously has had many very close conversations with Ed and Lorraine over the years. So it's interesting to hear some of that perspective. But one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had about it, and it's a two piece special that I've put out on the Grave Talks. If anyone's listening, they can go back. Probably about a year at least. It was talking with Laura DiDio, who was one of the original reporters on the case, who went with Lorraine and Ed to the house along with the television station, and witnessed the exorcism and witnessed the seance and witnessed all these things firsthand. And to hear that story being retold from one of the few people still alive that, you know, is even talking about it or would talk about it and would have the memory of it from a reporter perspective, I found very, very interesting. And just discussing everything from the ghost photo of the little boy and who that might be or what that might be, because she was in the house that night. There's been all these little things that have been very interesting And little nuggets, quite honestly, that have been discussed off the air that I cannot air because they, you know, they're just like, well, I've heard this, but I can't say it because it would get everybody in trouble. Has been very fascinating to me, too, on this case. What for you have been some of the things that over the years, beyond just the initial story that have fascinated you, have drawn you into the Amityville case?
Well, I mean, obviously, the first time I saw the movie and then had the book, I was young and fascinated by the fact that that could actually happen to people. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, that's just a movie. That's Hollywood.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you get older, you hear more about these types of things. And then it's like, well, I want to look into it a little further. So, yeah. You know, I picked up as much as I could. I'd read as much as I could. I've seen the different interviews with Ronnie DeFeo.
Yeah.
And his story changes too much. So that's why I have like a little skepticism now about what really could have happened.
Are you talking about
what I think about all the time is how he's able to walk around room to room with a shotgun. Nobody wakes up.
Yeah.
How is that possible? That's because shotguns are not quiet.
Yeah.
And no one woke up. They're all placed in their bed. Did he have help? Was it something else? I have no idea. That's the one that always tugs at me. Like, I'd love to know how that came to be because it just doesn't add up to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the Lutzes themselves were, you know, broke, basically, you know, went broke buying this house. Were they trumping it up? I don't know. I'd like to think they weren't because I like to believe in this stuff 100%.
I know.
There's a couple of, you know, you just want to believe it for face value and be like, oh, that's great. The walls bled. You guys ran out of the house. Awesome. But you just never know. So, but I like that too because it keeps us looking for more answers.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's why when I met Lorraine, I couldn't wait to ask that question. I was like a little child. I was like, can I ask you a question? You know, and
sure.
She was such a sweetheart. She was a beautiful woman. And that was incredible to be able to talk to her about it. I didn't get enough time. Like, I wasn't alone. So,
mm-hmm.
But hearing firsthand from her that was her most scary experience made me believe it a lot more.
Sure. Sure. It's obviously a case that has been represented in movies and books and everything to some extreme levels. And talking with those involved, everyone I've ever talked to, nobody has ever said, hey, yes, the movie and the book are 100% accurate. Everyone will flat out say, no, there's been liberties taken. But it's interesting just to hear about what actually did happen from what people remember. And in some cases, you'll hear people say things like, what actually did happen was actually far scarier than what was even put on screen. And another case that was like that, where someone actually did get to open up more about what happened versus what happened on screen. Obviously, another one that the Warrens did investigate would be the Conjuring House. And that's another interesting one where I had Andrea Perrin on the show several times, but the first time I had her on was probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And it was a very interesting conversation. The Conjuring had already come out. She was just coming out with her first books publicly. Mm-hmm. And we were, I think I was one of the first interviews that she had done. And it was one of the first episodes of our program, actually, too. And it was really interesting to get into that story because she really expounded upon the experiences that happened there. And her story, yes, it is far more scary than actually what occurred on screen. And you know, the liberties that were taken on screen, sure, it was a scary movie. But it's very interesting to see that where sometimes you think, oh, well, what's presented in the movies is going to be scarier than real life. Quite often with what we're talking about here, it's the other way around. There's just no way to really, I think, to present that in a 2-hour format, especially all of the years or months of buildup that these individuals go through and the anxiety that builds up to kind of a crescendo sometimes. There's no way of implanting that into someone watching a 2-hour movie to feel what that feels like. But very interesting just to hear about those cases. Tell me more about some of the other cases that you've been able to investigate that stand out to you, since we've been kind of talking about some that have some darker tones to them. How about you? Has there been any cases, they don't have to be famous by any means, but just things that you've investigated that ended up having darker tones, whether you knew it going in or not?
Well, it's funny you brought up the Conjuring House because I was just there last week.
Okay.
I've investigated the house before. I've done an overnight. I just stopped by last week with a friend, but I have spent overnight there, and I did have quite the experiences. To give you a I'll give you a little quick. I'll give you guys the Cliff's Notes. How's that?
Yeah.
So we would I went there, and I was just staying over. I'm friendly with the owner. He's a friend of mine. So we were just more or less just hanging out. It was last fall, and I wound up sleeping in the middle bedroom upstairs, which is one of the hot spots for activity in the house. And I was sleeping not well. I'm not going to lie. I didn't sleep very good in this house, but I was asleep. And on the second floor, the room is – it's absence of light, dark. I've never been in a darker spot. And there's actually a window in the room too, which makes no sense. But I was sound asleep, and this happened three times throughout the night. I was wide awake instantly as if something was standing right over me. And, of course, you wake up and you're like, what the hell's here? There's nothing. So I'm like, all right, okay. I get up the next morning, and next to the bed, I had my hat on the ground with, like, my phone in it. And I went to get my key to go put my stuff in the Jeep and leave. My key is nowhere to be found. So I'm like, all right. So I'm looking. The key's not in the bed. It's not under the bed. It's not downstairs. We're searching this entire house. My key is completely nowhere to be found. So I go outside. I'm getting kind of mad at this point because I just need to get out of there. And my Jeep is locked. So I know it's not in the Jeep, but I see, you know, on the off chance it is, I'll unzip the window, crawl in there, open the Jeep up. Now the alarm's going off. Now I know the key's not in there because you can't alarm it with the key in and then shut the door. It doesn't work that way. And I'm just standing there defeated, and I wear hats. My hat's on, and I kind of just look at the ground. I like rub my temples and move my hat a little bit, and the key falls right onto the ground between my feet. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? And yeah. I look at it for a second, like, did this just happen? So I pick the key up. I turn the alarm off. And my friend's like, where'd you find the key? I said, it just fell out of the air between my feet. And I was like, all right, it must have been in my hat, right? Like, it must have been stuck in the elastic band of the hat. I tried all sorts of different stuff. There's no way it would have been in my hat because my hat was tight and I would have felt it. And I think there's a trickster spirit there that was playing around with me, didn't want me to leave, wanted me to know it was there. I have no idea, but that's an experience that I'm always going to carry with me. And that house definitely has activity. There's no denying that. And it's an incredible place, incredible piece of history.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Matt Warner about the many locations that he has investigated and his thoughts on the paranormal. You can find him on YouTube. Just look up Warner Paranormal, also on Facebook. In part two of our conversation, we'll continue talking about many famous haunted locations, including the Conjuring House. And are the entities at the Conjuring House good or bad? What does Matt believe that the Conjuring House still has haunting it after all these years? What do the resident spirits of the Conjuring House feel about their home being used for investigations? What do you do when investigating a house where a spirit does not like or want you there? Has Matt ever been attacked by a spirit, and what happened? And has there ever been a time where Matt felt that there's a location that should not be paranormally investigated, or put just simply off limits? All of that and more in the second half of our interview with Matt. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.